A precision operation that's part of a grander scheme or a one-off magic trick to score PSYOPs points against an enemy. Either way, what to make of a second day of exploding devices that have killed at least a dozen, wounded more than 3,000. Hezbollah's response awaited after a security breach that will go down in the history books. How did those recently equipped pagers and now walkie-talkies explode? Why the aftershock in several regions in Lebanon this Wednesday? We'll examine possible scenarios. We'll see how Lebanon's digesting its worst casualty toll since the August 2021 Port of Beirut explosion, the options available to Hezbollah and its Iranian backers. Note that Tehran's ambassador to Lebanon was among the injured on Tuesday. And finally, we'll ask how this timing impacts what's already a conflict on two fronts. For now, Israel, tight-lipped, doesn't have to claim responsibility for this kind of derring-do operation that's normally the reserve of a John le Carré novel or a James Bond movie. But does technical prowess imply political smarts? Time will tell. Today in the France 24 debate, what to make of the targeting of Hezbollah. And joining us from Beirut is correspondent Rawad Taha. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening.
From Jerusalem, correspondent Iris Mockler is with us. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
From New York, he's a former Israeli Deputy National Security Advisor, Chuck Freilich, political science professor at Tel Aviv and Columbia Universities. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And here in the studio, we're with Nadim Houri, Executive Director of the Arab Reform Initiative. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Let's begin with the latest, Rawad Taha. A second day of these attacks.
Definitely, indeed. This looks like the second episode of some sort of a science fiction series. So yesterday it was the beepers, the pagers. Today it was the walkie-talkies. We have reports of hundreds of walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah, in particular a specific model, ICOM V-82, which is supposedly a Japanese-made walkie-talkie released in the year of 2005. A number of those devices, primarily used by Hezbollah, also exploded simultaneously or within the range of the same 10 to 15 minutes earlier this afternoon on Wednesday. That led to at least 10 killed and around 300 or more injured. Not a lot of burden on the hospitals, unlike the scene we saw yesterday in Beirut after the pagers explosions series, where around 3,000 were injured and also around 10 were killed. There was no call for any blood donation today. The hospitals were, even though they were at full capacity, they were able to handle the second wave of attacks, which occurred only a few hours ago. This is coming at an unprecedented time, very unusual 48 hours for Lebanon and for Hezbollah and for its base as well.
Yeah, a dozen killed on Tuesday, but the wounds are serious. We can listen to one doctor at Mount Lebanon University Hospital saying between 60 to 70% of the patients he's treated have eye injuries.
At least if we could save one of the eyes, this is already an achievement. Unfortunately, like I said, some of the patients we had to remove both eyes, and this is what can, I mean, it kills me. And as I said previously, in my past 25 years in practice, I never removed as many eyes as I did yesterday.
Rawad Taha, you were reporting about this earlier when you described what the scene was like in the Lebanese capital this Wednesday. A big blow for morale, particularly for Hezbollah.
Indeed. Over the past year, there were a lot of security breaches that have occurred in the war in terms of precision assassination, precision airstrikes that were conducted by Israel in various parts of Lebanon. We saw the assassination of Hamas official Saleh al-Aruri in January in Beirut's southern suburb. We also witnessed the assassination of the most senior Hezbollah commander, Fuad Shukr, in Beirut's southern suburb a few weeks ago. We saw tens of targeted assassinations that happened in southern Lebanon for senior military commanders of Radwan unit and other leading units within Hezbollah, the commanders of the drones unit, the commanders of the rocket launchers unit. But those were very precise targeted assassinations that already showed some sort of a security breach. But something at this scale where thousands of pager devices explode yesterday on Tuesday and hundreds of walkie-talkie devices explode simultaneously earlier this afternoon on Wednesday, yes, this was a very big blow for Hezbollah's base in particular, a very big moral blow. In the past, during those assassinations, the exchange of fire was still going on between between Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon and the Israeli army in northern Israel. So Hezbollah could easily come up back then with a statement that says, we launched a number of missiles, we launched a number of drones, we targeted a number of bases, and that is the retaliation for the assassination of Saleh al-Haruri, the assassination of Fuad Shukr, and all the other assassinations. But something at this scale, what kind of retaliation that could possibly boost the morale for Hezbollah's base and regain its strength and confidence is the question.
Iris Makler, before we dive into this operation and the nature of it and the specifics of it and the details that we know about it, just a word on the mood on your side of the border. There's been no comment on the operation itself, I know, but in the last hour, the Israeli defense minister, Yoav Gallant, has said that the center of gravity of the war is moving north.
That's right. That's something he has said before over the last month, not over the previous, the 10 months before that. But he has been saying that. He has consistently said it's time to move focus to the north. And now with these attacks, the focus is moving to the north. The timing is the interesting question. You know, was it intended to be now? If it were intended to be now, these are the precursors. Disorient your enemy and start a ground offensive and start airstrikes. We haven't seen that. So there has been this suggestion that it wasn't meant to start now, that there was some suggestion that Israel learnt that Hezbollah, two or three Hezbollah operatives, were becoming suspicious of these new pagers, and so they were forced to act or decided to act, use it or lose it, yesterday. I've heard the same thing said about today. You know, it wasn't necessary to carry out the attack with the walkie-talkies, but if you have them there, then you should use them before Hezbollah becomes suspicious or tells everybody to get rid of them as well. So perhaps a timing forced on Israel, in a sense, by the suspicions within Hezbollah, but will there now be this massive war that both sides have been avoiding for 11 and a half months? That's the question being asked here.
And we're going to pursue that hypothesis that the timing may have been forced on Israel in a moment. Lots of unknowns. Why the need for new pagers for those Hezbollah members? Who even made them? That's not clear yet. Mm-hmm. How did they detonate? Karis Garland has that story.
In the middle of this Beirut supermarket, just one of hundreds of simultaneous explosions. And after such a large-scale and sophisticated operation, many are just asking how it was carried out. Citing American and other officials, the New York Times reports that Israel implanted remote switches and highly explosive material next to the pager's batteries. After images of destroyed pagers circulated on social media, a Taiwan-based company called Gold Apollo surfaced as a possible manufacturer. A Lebanese security source told Reuters that Hezbollah had ordered 5,000 pagers from the company. But on Wednesday, Gold Apollo said the pagers that blew up were actually made by its Hungarian partner, which has a license to use the Gold Apollo brand.
Over the past 3 years, Gold Apollo established a long-term private label authorization with this agency called BAC, allowing them to use our trademark for regional sales. This is not an Apollo product.
Nonetheless, the Hungarian government refuted that assessment.
Authorities have confirmed that the company in question is a trading intermediary with no manufacturing or operational site in Hungary. It has one manager registered at its declared address, and the reference devices have never been in Hungary.
Lebanon faces a range of sanctions from the United States, the European Union, and their Western partners. Because of this, and to avoid dealing directly with Hezbollah, shipments of goods are often handled through middlemen and face long clearance times before entering the country. Al Jazeera reports that the pagers spent 3 months at a Lebanese port before being transferred to Hezbollah, and the group suspects that Israel managed to alter the devices during this time. Israel has not yet commented on the explosions.
Well, in the last 24 hours, a lot of people have been playing armchair ballistics expert. We decided to bring on a real one. Joining us from San Antonio, Texas, arms historian N.R. Jensen-Jones, director of the Armament Research Services Consultancy. Thank you for being with us here on France 24. Let me begin by asking you, there's two hypotheses that have been going, around. One, explosives were put inside of the devices, and the other that there's some kind of mechanism by which they can make the batteries overheat. What seems most likely? We're going to have to, we seem to have an audio issue, so we'll try to get back to you in a moment. Chuck Freilich, while we reconnect with San Antonio, your thoughts, have you ever seen an operation like this one, and your thoughts on what seems plausible?
Well, first of all, whoever took it, conducted this, I think this is really going to go down as one of the more brilliant intelligence and operational actions in history. But the real importance here is where it puts us in the overall strategic picture. Now, the conflict with Hezbollah has been going on for 40 years now, with ups and downs over time. And what we've seen in the last year, since October 7th, since the war in Gaza began, is that Hezbollah opened fire against Israel October 8th, and has been firing basically incessantly throughout these almost 12 months. Israel's northern rim has become a ghost town. Something like 60,000 people still a year later cannot return to their homes. And the rest of the north is under constant fire, people experiencing sometimes dozens of alerts every day. That means they have to run to their shelters. And sometimes people actually get hurt and worse. This is a situation that is intolerable for any country. Imagine if people in the western half of Paris were firing on the eastern part. And the border, the people in the north literally abut people in southern Lebanon. You can just see into people's living rooms across the border. And many of them, or possibly even most of them, are Hezbollah.
So here's the question. This was the question that was posed in a sense earlier by Iris. Is this this kind of operation knocking out people? It positions a lot of them in responsibility. Is this the prelude to something bigger, a major airstrikes, a major attack on Lebanon?
Okay. Well, first of all, this has been extraordinarily precise and targeted. And I think your correspondent, Rawad, said the word precision more times in his few minutes than I've heard for a long time. This may have been the prelude. This was certainly an attempt to change the situation in the north that I'm describing. And the cabinet in Israel, I believe it was the day before yesterday, adopted a formal decision to add bringing people back to their homes in the north as a formal war objective. In the short term, I think there's an objective of achieving greater deterrence, because clearly Israel's deterrence vis-a-vis Hezbollah has deteriorated in recent years. And so there's an attempt to do that. And in that sense, it may be actually an attempt to forestall the wider war. But there is also a deep argument in Israel about whether this is the time where, for lack of better choice, and since the diplomatic efforts have failed, Israel has to either respond or take advantage of a Hezbollah attack or initiate the wider conflict on its own.
Well, let me put this to Nadi Mouri then. Does this forestall a wider war?
Look, before we get into that, I actually want to push back on this issue that this is a clean, precise attack. Of the 12 people who were killed yesterday, two were children and two were medical nurses. If you actually listen to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, he described that these simultaneous attacks are actually illegal and they violate international human rights law and international humanitarian law. And I want to put it, not because someone is somehow affiliated with Hezbollah that they all become legitimate targets. If tomorrow Israel has 500,000 reservists, are they a legitimate target if they're sitting on the beach in Tel Aviv? Are they a legitimate target if they're going to their hospital? Are they a legitimate target if they go to a supermarket? What rules of war is Israel playing with? This whole idea that this is some sort of James Bondish thing, I've been talking to family, friends, and colleagues all day long yesterday and today. What they're describing is a city under terror. If this had happened in any city in Europe or North America, the headlines would be terrorist attack, terrorist attack. But because this is happening in Beirut, somehow we're all here talking about, you know, the technical aspects of it. Again, of the 12 that we know died, two kids, two medical nurses. I don't know if this counts as the most precise attack ever. The doctors, what they're describing is basically what you, and we saw one of your documentaries, limbs, pieces, you know, pieces of fingers falling off and eyes. Actually, I think this was an indiscriminate attack. And it shows the low respect for norms that Israel has been displaying egregiously in Gaza and now that it's displaying in Lebanon.
There's the issue of how it's playing in Israel, how it's playing in Lebanon, how it's playing for a wider audience. But again, there's that question of exactly why this is taking place at this particular point in time. A news website Al Monitor spoke to sources who suspect that Israel had to play its hand sooner than planned. After a Hezbollah member in Lebanon suspected foul play with the pager several days ago, the person was killed. The sources said, according to the sources, days later another Hezbollah member suspected that the devices were compromised and planned to alert his superiors. Again, I ask the question to you, Iris Machler, because you're in Israel right now. Do you feel as though you're on the eve of a bigger conflict, or is there the sense that they had these tools at their disposal and the window to use them was about to close?
I think that the two don't contradict each other. They had these two tools at their disposal, or they made the choice to have these tools at their disposal. The window was about to close, but that could also mean that what comes next is a much broader war. And that is being discussed by experts in, especially people who follow Arab language news here, and they are very concerned that Israel will be dragging itself, if you like, into a much broader war. I just want to remind you of the arsenal that Hezbollah has and has not used during this war. You know, there's tens of thousands of long-range precision-guided missiles that Hezbollah has not used, and Israel has not bombed those sites. As I heard one analyst say, it's like sign language. And if that equation changes, then, you know, the price that ordinary people, that civilians on both sides will pay, will be thousands of dead, if not tens of thousands of dead. And I think that is what does worry people here and should stay the hand of anyone who thinks that simply broadening a war will solve any problems here.
Rawad Taha, does it feel in Beirut like this is the eve of a wider conflict?
There is a general sense among the entire Lebanese population, even among Hezbollah supporters, that they are not seeking a full-scale war with Israel. This has been the case over the past year in particular. What I generally believe is that Hezbollah is cornered and was cornered by its own decision to link the conflict in southern Lebanon to the ongoing conflict in Gaza. So even Hezbollah is not seeking a full-scale war. If Hezbollah wanted or was seeking a full-scale war, that could have erupted weeks ago after the assassination of senior commander Fuad Shukr and the death of a number of civilians in that airstrike as well when the building collapsed. So that was enough of a reason to push Hezbollah into an all-out war with Israel. But Hezbollah explicitly mentioned that it is not seeking a full-scale war with Israel, that this war of attrition is in support of Hamas and Gaza. It is in support of reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. So to some extent, Hezbollah is cornered by its own decision to link the two conflicts together. But no one here in Lebanon, including Hezbollah supporters, are seeking a full-scale war with Israel because everyone knows how devastating such a war would be. In terms of what's the sentiment today on the eve of following those two attacks, I still see a sense of a national unity that we haven't seen in Lebanon in a long time. In our past conversations, we talked a lot about polarization in the country, especially in regards to Hezbollah's decision to start this war of attrition in support of Hamas. But today, and following the past 48 hours, there is a great sense of unity among the Lebanese people. We saw it in the blood donation drives, and we also saw it in the political opponents of Hezbollah, whose statements were very supportive, very aggressive against the what they called the Israeli aggression, and especially given the fact that a number of bypassers were also injured in those pagers attacks, including a three-year-old girl. So today there's no talk of the risk of a wider conflict. Today there is still a sense of national unity, and there is some sort of a questioning of trying to understand what happened within the past 48 hours.
All right, let's bring in now by telephone NR Jensen Jones from San Antonio, arms historian, director of the Armament Research Services Consultancy. Apologies for the video link issues. Let me ask you then, what do you make of it? What kind of devices are we? What kind of an operation is this? What? How did these pagers and now walkie-talkies explode?
Yeah, look, it's a very good question. I think what we're seeing here, the scale of what we're seeing is certainly unprecedented. I think we've heard that term a few times now, but it's fair to say that the complexity of this sort of supply chain attack, which is the method of infiltrating the supply chain somewhere along its route to swap out or to include explosive devices into the comms devices, is really something unusual, and it speaks to a very strong intelligence capability and a special missions capability that Israel has demonstrated. So I think there's a lot to be said about where it might fit into a bigger conflict plan or whether it's meant to send a message, for example. But regardless of the intent, the execution is such that it really does demonstrate some very strong technical capability.
Do you think it's possible that these devices could have been manufactured in some third-party country and brought into Lebanon with explosives inside of them?
It's a very good question. Again, we're sort of in an early speculating stage, of course, but it's definitely within the realm of possibility. I see a lot of different scenarios that could have unfolded, you know, where Israel potentially could have inserted itself into the supply chain. But in any event, it was done in a fashion that went undetected, at least for some time, according to reporting. So it shows, again, a pretty robust capability, whether that was conducted in a third party or inside Lebanon itself.
Yeah, and you talked about a supply chain operation. In any of the operation of that kind, it gets interesting when you try to follow the money, or in this case, the supply chain. When the day began, the focus was on Taiwanese manufacturer Gold Apollo, as we saw in that report earlier, quick to deny it ever made these pagers, insisting it only sells marketing rights. And it sold them to a company called BAC Consulting, headquartered out of Hungary's capital, Budapest. There's no sign of a factory there, no revenue declared before 2022. Its street address, you can see it here, is a home in a residential neighborhood. The company's website lists as its chief executive an earth sciences PhD, Christiana Barsoni Arcidiacono, I hope I pronounced it correctly. U.S. broadcaster NBC managed to reach her. She said, "I don't make the pagers. I'm just the intermediate. I think you got it wrong." So, again, it's that question of where were these devices made, NR Jensen Jones?
Yeah, I mean, again, an open question. I think in these sorts of attacks, these complex supply chain attacks, which historically we've associated more closely with efforts to insert hardware backdoors into networking devices, for example, with cyber warfare. In these types of attacks, we expect to see a number of shell companies, a number of subsidiaries, cutouts or dupes. So it's not uncommon for a complex business relationship to sit atop this kind of end goal. It's just, as I say, you know, I hate to overuse the phrase, but it really is unprecedented in terms of the scale of this lethal distribution. Historically, it might be one or two targeted killings. We've seen Israel use explosives inside communications devices previous to this attack. But this is certainly on such a scale that it shows, you know, a real determination to achieve this kind of effect.
Chuck Frelich, what's your hunch as to where these devices were manufactured?
I don't know, and I really don't think it's particularly helpful to speculate about it. It's interesting for the James Bond dimension, but the real issue here is the fact that we have a terrorist organization, which is recognized as such by most of the world, including a fair part of the Arab world, sitting on Israel's northern border with somewhere in the range of up to 150,000 rockets and drones, a few thousand drones, and continually firing on northern Israel.
But we've been talking, Chuck, about the different targeted attacks against Hezbollah over the past 11 months. In this particular case, is there the sense that there's very high degree of intelligence when it comes to how to get, if these explosives, because it is important to figure out how these explosives got into these devices. A high degree of intelligence, some kind of mole that's helping along inside of Lebanon?
Well, again, I don't know. And if I did, I wouldn't say. The point is that this required exquisite intelligence and a truly remarkable ability to hit almost just the intended targets. There were a few thousand people injured. Out of the few thousand, there are now 12 dead, of whom Hezbollah has taken credit for 8, that they're fighters. So we're talking in the end for potentially 4 innocent bystanders, which is 4 too many. It's always unfortunate. But we're talking about a war with a terrorist organization which calls for Israel's destruction. And they mean it. And it's time for people to take it seriously in the way that they didn't take seriously what happened with Hamas on October 7th.
And again, the question I'm asking you is because you're a former deputy national security advisor. Why is the intelligence so strong when it comes to Hezbollah? And there were all these lapses that we've yet to find out about when it comes to Gaza and Hamas.
Israel screwed up. To put it quite simply, we made the most egregious mistakes imaginable, and that led to October 7th. And now I'm happy to say if this was an Israeli operation, then this is the way Israel is supposed to operate. This is the way it's supposed to be done. I mean, how do you know who the Hezbollah people are walking around with their beepers or their walkie-talkies? I mean, this requires incredible intelligence. To do one or two people would be impressive. But as your previous interviewee was saying, to do it on a scale like this is truly remarkable. It's unprecedented. And to do it in a way with almost no casualties is remarkable.
Nadim Houri, what does Hezbollah do?
I don't know. I mean, clearly, this is a big blow to Hezbollah. I think they themselves recognize it. As your journalist in Beirut said, Hezbollah is not keen on a full-scale war. It's true. They've, in a way, put themselves in a situation where they don't want to go back on their stated position. And Hassan Nasrallah has said it repeatedly, that their priority is to support Gaza to get to a ceasefire. Will this attack yesterday and today and the increasing cost and obviously the fact that they're aware now that they already knew that there was some penetration, intelligence penetration of their systems. Now their communication system seems to be completely exposed. I don't think they would want to rush into full-scale war. Do they feel the need to retaliate? Yes. Hassan Nasrallah is going to speak tomorrow. But I think Hezbollah, and they've learned that from the Iranians, they have an approach to time that's a bit different than the rest. I don't think they will be in a rush. that we might, you know, if I put my analyst hat on, they're going to take their time. They're probably now trying to figure out what happened, where are the points of weakness. One thing with Hezbollah that we've seen in the 40 years of their history is they have been incredibly resilient. They've managed, you know, Israel assassinated one of their former secretary general, Raghib Harb. They ended up with Hassan Nasrallah, most likely even more formidable leader for Hezbollah. We've seen it after 2006, how actually Hezbollah came out stronger after what was a devastating war. And I think this is the dilemma a lot of people face today. And I do think that there will be unintended consequences for what happened yesterday and today. And I think your journalist was saying it. Lebanon is a divided country. But, you know, what happened yesterday and today actually is uniting people. The same thing happened in 2006. Same thing happened of the brutality of Israel during their occupation of Lebanon until 2000. So even if Lebanon is in agreement, so actually I think Hezbollah now...
Let me ask you about this, because when there was the Port of Beirut explosion, the anger and resentment was directed squarely at Hezbollah itself, because it's considered as part of those who that it's on its watch. That it happened, and that more than 2,000 people were injured. Are the people who were outraged then now going to rally behind Hezbollah?
I don't know if they would rally behind, but they also recognize, again, people have felt terror in Beirut yesterday. When I say people, I mean Beiruti residents that maybe don't like Hezbollah. My friends kept hearing ambulances for hours and hours. Anyone who lived through 9/11 would know this creates anxiety. So this idea, and today the continuous explosions, the fact that people found that cars were exploding in parking lots at the AUB Medical Center and so forth, it doesn't mean that, you know, suddenly all of Lebanese are behind Hezbollah, but it will mean that more and more Lebanese are, you know, are directing their anger towards Israel and less towards Hezbollah. And there is a natural phenomenon of solidarity that can be understood. Again, I think, you know, Israel will say, oh, this is high tech. But, you know, the having supersonic, you know, sound barrier, airplanes breaking the sound barrier over Beirut as a way of intimidating Hezbollah. You know, it doesn't intimidate Hezbollah fighters. It does intimidate the Lebanese population. But guess what? The Lebanese population, like most populations, when they're intimidated, they become more defiant. So, I actually think there might be some unintended consequences. But again, this, as I think, as your guest said, Hezbollah started as an unintended consequence of Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, you know? And I wonder violence, all these wars, what other unintended consequences they will have, obviously for Lebanon.
Let's get back to the present now. There was earlier this year, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah telling militants to turn off their cell phones. Quote, Israel no longer needs collaborators. Its surveillance devices are in your pockets. If you're looking for the Israeli agent, look at the phone in your hands and those of your wives and children. NR Jensen Jones, just a quick question on this, because if the pagers are booby-trapped, if the walkie-talkies are booby-trapped, if you know not to speak on your cell phones, what do you do in that case?
Yeah, look, talking about intent and understanding what the purpose was, obviously it's speculation at this stage, but one very reasonable thought could be that it's to push people away from those devices. We know pagers, for example, are more difficult to conduct some of the traditional signals intercepts on, and towards networks which maybe are less secure or have already been compromised by Israeli intelligence. So I think it's an interesting dimension of the attack. The other argument that's been made, of course, is about preparation of the battle space, the notion that perhaps it's a precursor to an invasion. We haven't seen indications of that. In fact, I'd probably push back a little bit against that analysis and instead say that I think this sends a very clear message to Hezbollah that Israeli intelligence has penetrated your networks. Israeli intelligence understands your supply chain. Israeli intelligence is able to strike you, in your homes. So it's for, you know, whatever your political assessment of the situation is, like I say, from a technical perspective, it's a very formidable message to send.
All right. And meanwhile, on the other side of the border, and we talked about it on Tuesday with Iris Makler, there was this warning coming from the Israeli government that it would no longer accept the status quo. It was a nod to the 70,000 who've been displaced in northern Israel since October the 7th. Some of the locals, though, are saying too little, too late.
First of all, I don't believe in the cabinet. They're all liars and cheaters, and they slept for a whole year. They slept, they woke up, and then they decided that this is a goal. The Prime Minister said he wants security, a complete victory. But the only thing that matters to him is his chair.
Iris Makler, is that opinion an outlier? Or, again, it's the question of how much traction or how much support Israel's government will get from what's happened the last 48 hours?
I think that opinion that Benjamin Netanyahu is acting for political reasons rather than necessarily in the interests of the state is widely held. I'm not saying all Israelis think it, but they think it in relationship to the hostage negotiations. I'm not saying there would be a hostage deal necessarily. You know, Yahya Sinwar is a formidable opponent in that sense. But I'm not sure that the Israeli public believes that Benjamin Netanyahu is 110% behind that. And they think that the thing that's holding him back is his own political survival. And what that man said about the north of Israel is a similar thought, which is he's now, after 11 and a half months, woken up to the fact that there are displaced people in the north of Israel and that their lot has been a very difficult one. 46 people, I believe, have been killed by Hezbollah incoming rockets. So it's as if he's woken up now, and the suspicion that he's only doing it to prolong, to extend his political life is quite widely held in Israel. And I think that's why you see, excuse me, so many people on the streets, tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, protesting about the war in Gaza. And there is this phrase that I think we've discussed before. People here say that you need a forever war if you want to be a forever prime minister. And that's the allegation that's put against Benjamin Netanyahu. I think that's a very difficult position for a democratic leader to be in. If the people don't believe you have their interests at heart, it's very hard for you to lead them in a war.
Chuck Freilich, does Benjamin Netanyahu come out of all of this strengthened or weakened?
Well, short term, it will strengthen him because the people, it's not just the people in the north, in Israel generally, there is a belief that the situation has to be changed in order to let the northern residents go home. There's, of course, a divergence of opinion about how to do that, but there is very strong support for measures that promote that objective, and this will be viewed as successful in that regard. But I think it's absolutely true, as Iris was saying, that Netanyahu is thought by a significant percentage of the Israeli public, myself included, to have at a bare minimum used the hostage negotiations and the Gaza war as a way of keeping himself in power, avoiding the criminal charges he faces. And one can't but question, was that in any way related to the timing of the current events? And the answer is it might possibly be so, but that doesn't change the fact that this is the type of thing that had to be done in any event. And from an Israeli perspective, I think it's just a tragedy that we have a prime minister who's created a situation in which we can even suspect him of this kind of thinking.
In the Hope Springs Eternal Department, the U.S. Secretary of State back in the Middle East yet again to try and push a ceasefire plan in Cairo this Wednesday. Antony Blinken, of course, drawn onto the subject of exploding devices.
The United States did not know about, nor was it involved in, these incidents, and we're still gathering the information and gathering the facts. Broadly speaking, we've been very clear, and we remain very clear, about the importance of all parties avoiding any steps that could further escalate the conflict that we're trying to resolve in Gaza, to see it spread to other fronts. It's clearly not in the interest of anyone involved to see that happen.
You know, it's UN week next week, Nadeem Houri. There'll be a lot of world leaders, including Benjamin Netanyahu, in New York. Your thoughts listening to Antony Blinken there?
Yeah, I thought you're gonna. I thought he sounded like a UN mediator. The U.S. these days is not convincing anyone. It's become completely ineffective.
Why is he back in the Middle East?
Well, I think there are two divergent views. I mean, one says, yes, they truly want to contain the situation. because it's in everyone's interest to keep things calm, because we know that the next conflict will not just be like 2006 between Israel and Hezbollah, but Iran and its other regional allies will feel the need to get involved. But they're not bringing anything new to the table. So a lot of people now in the region are starting to think that these visits maybe are just giving Israel, and particularly Netanyahu, more time to get into a better situation. But I think the U.S. is losing a lot of credibility, even amongst many of its long allies like Jordan and others. Is simply not seen, not only, you know, it's always been seen as partial to Israel, but the worst part now is it's seen as partial to Israel, but also ineffective. And that's a bad look for a superpower.
Rawad Taha, the thoughts again, and as we're speaking, they've raised the death toll in Lebanon to 14.
Yes, I have the update. It was just received by the Ministry of Health. So this is regarding the second attack. So we're talking here about the walkie-talkie attack. 14 dead, more than 450 injured in the walkie-talkies attack earlier this afternoon.
Where's the light at the end of the tunnel is, the I guess, the question. Are people, is anyone seeing that there's a possibility that people can dial this down?
I think the main question remains is what's going to happen in Gaza, and what's this, what are the prospects moving forward for the entire region? And I think the Lebanese, as usual, are stuck in this geopolitical game. You have Yahya Sinwar on one hand leading Hamas, one of the most and Yahya Sinwar, one of the most radical extremists, if one can say. And then you have an Israeli far right wing government with Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, and Nasrallah here sticking the conflict back to what's going on in Gaza. So I think today the Lebanese are a hostage of three parties, if one can say. One is Yahya Sinwar, the second is Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing allies, and finally Nasrallah, who took the decision to link the front in southern Lebanon to what's going on in Gaza. So the next few days could be telling, but definitely if there is some sort of a last-minute ceasefire deal that could be achieved in Gaza, that could possibly de-escalate the situation also here in southern Lebanon. Because we know for a fact that the Americans have been working on some sort of a de-escalation, a border deal between Israel and southern Lebanon on a wide range of conflicting points has been already in discussion for years. And especially after the success of the maritime border agreement between Israel and Lebanon a few years back, when the U.S. mediated that deal. So a land border agreement is not far-fetched, but the question is Israel ready to do that without going into a larger scale ground maneuver or a larger scale assault? And is Hezbollah ready to do that even if the conflict in Gaza was not over and the ceasefire there was not achieved? So I think those are the two questions that that should be put up on the table today.
And certainly they'll be up for offer, and we'll be talking about it. I want to thank you so much, Rawad Taha, for being with us from Beirut. Chuck Freilich in New York, where UN Week is about to begin. Iris Mockler in Jerusalem. Nadim Houri, thank you for being with us here. Thanks as well to NR Jensen Jones for being with us from San Antonio for his insights on this operation. More on our website, france24.com.